The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I am another one of your hosts, Jody Green from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
And I'm your third host, Michael Scavarla from Penn State.
We got you in mid-stretch or something.
You did.
Yeah, like a big bear getting ready for winter.
Getting ready for the podcast.
Limbering up.
Gotta limber up, yeah.
I was doing the how now brown cow exercise before I got on the horn. Yeah, so you gotta limber up everything. How are you guys doing?
Allergic.
Full of allergies. Jody's white blood cell count is quite high today, it sounds like.
Yeah, like Mucin XD is my friend, but not my friend.
Right. You have to get allergy shots. I've been doing that for over a year now.
I guess I just have to get out of denial.
Yep. Allergies are becoming worse and worse, it seems like.
Yeah. Climate change.
I didn't say it. You said it. It may be true.
I'm saying it.
Could be.
Mike and I have long been allergy sufferers, I think.
Yeah. I got allergy shots. I actually got weaned off them. I got them every week for over 12 years as a kid. And then I had them long enough, they weaned me off. And it's been pretty good until the last couple of years. And then it's been getting worse.
Not giving me a lot of hope here. I endorse Zizol. That's my allergy medication. This is like the nerdiest introduction to a podcast ever.
Hey, everybody, we're talking about our allergies for all that.
What kind of drugs are you taking?
I'm on Zizol currently. You know, the one with the owl in the commercial. So we sounds like we're dealing with allergies in Nebraska. How are you doing, Mike?
Pretty good, I think.
Busy?
Yeah. My student is working on a water mite project.
Right.
And he collected his samples for his summer collection. And a couple weeks ago, we went through some and I taught him how to identify the mites in those samples. And so he's been taking the last couple weeks to look at samples on his own that we haven't gone through together. And he identified stuff and then passed the samples on to me to confirm his ID. So I got to spend all day yesterday looking at mites, which is the first time that's happened in quite a while.
That sounds like a cup-filling experience for you.
It was very enjoyable. And then I woke up this morning and logged into my email, which I had not checked because I was looking at mites all day.
First mistake, having an email address.
And I wanted to die.
I was asking and checking in with you guys because I will tell you, I had somebody come up to me recently at a speaking event and they were like, I listened to your podcast. I just listened to the one about fall armyworm. It was an agent, actually. And he was saying, I thought that the introduction was very funny because you were all saying like, life is fine. I'm doing so well. But then you were basically like, but I can't wait for cold to come in and kill everything that I work with because I have too much stuff on my plate. They thought we were all sort of like hiding our our pain or something.
I mean,
well, someone asked me, like, what do you do in the winter? I'm like, we still have lots of work to do. It's just
Catch up on all the stuff that we kicked down the road during the summer.
I mean, like for Jody, she's still got to deal with bed bugs and termites. People may find those and bring them in. Mike's going to catch up on all the bugs that he collected over the summer and have to identify them probably.
I get about half as many requests in the winter as I do in the summer because people find all the indoor home pests that they have not seen all summer because they've been outside.
Right. Or they thought those mysterious bites all over their body were mosquitoes all summer until it was December and they realized, oh, maybe I have bed bugs.
Yeah. Yep.
So that's kind of how we're doing. I hope everybody that's listening is doing well. We have an exciting announcement. Our next show, the one after this one, will be with Dr. Erica McAllister, and we are going to be having our Halloween spectacular. We always try to do something fun around Halloween time. It's a big deal for the three of us here in the U.S., and we are going to be talking to her about parasitic flies and her book. So if you have any questions that you'd like us to ask Erica, please send those in through Twitter or find us on the blog and send us an email there. But we think that'll be a really great show. We're looking forward to having her on. But today, we're going to be talking about an invasive species that I think all of us have dealt with in some different ways here this summer, different kinds of questions, different sorts of stories. We're going to be talking about the spotted lanternfly, which is something that started in the U.S. in Mike's neck of the woods, right?
In Berks County, Pennsylvania.
What's Berks County like? Have I ever been there? Have you ever
been there? I've never been there. No? It's out east.
Okay.
I grew up in the western part of the state, so I've never actually been. It should be nice. All of Pennsylvania is gorgeous.
Right. So it says Benjamin Franklin.
Do all the invasive species come to Pennsylvania first because it's so great there?
No. Emerald ash borer started in Michigan. But what we do have is Philadelphia, which is a port town. Like Chicago and like other places, we often get invasives first here because we're just importing a lot of stuff. Ports of entry are often the first places you find invasive species for reasons that are probably pretty obvious.
Marmorated.
Yep. We got those here first as well for the exact same reason.
I think you should change your state slogan to first in your hearts, first in invasive species or something to that effect.
I would be very curious, and maybe this is published out there somewhere, to like go through all of the invasive species that we know about in the US and chart like where they were first discovered and where we think they came from and see like what's the major epicenter for like importing them, or is it pretty well spread out everywhere?
I think that would be an interesting look. Yeah, because I mean, we could go to like New Jersey for Asian longhorn tick and Japanese beetle, Pennsylvania for the ones we've mentioned, EAB, Michigan. There's lots of possibilities.
Gypsy moth up in the Northeast.
Yeah, I think that we could have lots of interesting stories to come out of that. So why are we talking about the spotted lanternfly here today? What is it that has kind of prompted this, Jody?
Well, they're bad.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful, but they're so beautiful.
True. Yeah,
I think that is bad.
That's one thing that kind of pops up whenever we talk about this with people is, well, how can that be a bad bug? Look how pretty it is. It's so gorgeous. It's almost like a moth. People want to give it honorary lepidopteran status and move it out of Hemiptera.
Yeah, and it's called the lanternfly, so everyone calls it a fly. And when you think of what people do fear, and I'm going to say the murder hornet, and you think about the spotted lanternfly, what it looks like, what it can do and the damage that it can cause, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of money, a lot of industry, economy that can be damaged because of this.
Do you want to describe what it looks like for the listeners in this audio podcast?
Let's describe the pest. We talked about how beautiful it was. If you had to describe it, like, how would you describe it? Like, I would just say pretty. Like, everybody always sends me, if anyone's traveling and they know I like bugs, they'll send me a picture. And I'm like, oh, geez, no, don't bring that back.
I think sometimes the way I start out describing it to people is that it does have a sort of cicada-like shape, particularly when its wings are closed, or tent-like.
Did you know, I found in a publication that it has been called the spot clothing wax cicada, or the Chinese blistering cicada. So it's funny that you say that.
Interesting. Yeah. It is a relative. So, I mean, it makes sense that there would be some physical similarities there. So that's sort of where I usually start with, is trying to get people to say, okay, see how it looks kind of like a cicada. Where do you start, Mike?
I like that. I might steal it. I usually start with color. And how would you, I don't know. I'm very bad at describing colors. I've got like 8 colors in my palette.
Oh yeah, that's like me. And then the dark and light version, right? Like, oh, that's dark blue. Oh, that's light blue.
It's like a dark brownish red, I guess. Or
so I think it might gray. Be some of your Penn State stuff, actually, Mike, is the best description that I've seen, is that it's pinkish khaki, which I agree with.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
It has a pinkish khaki color to it.
Yep. I like that.
Like you have khaki pants and you spilt some wine on them, but you got most of it out, but not quite all of it. And there's this weird spot on there. That's the color.
I like it. And then it's got like these darker kind of blackish spots all over it.
Yeah. It mixes stripes with spots on its front wings, which is a bit of a fashion faux pas. But once it opens its wings, it's got some, not warning coloration, I guess, but more of a startle coloration, right?
It's both. Yeah. It's got these bright red bits on its hind wings that it can flash.
And it's got yellow on the body.
Mm-hmm. The females that are ready to lay eggs have the yellow.
And then the nymphs are like Dalmatians, but backwards.
Yep.
Guys, we're describing it terrible. Like there's no,
so that's,
sometimes
that's,
they're red and black.
I think spots. It's perfect.
Jody's right. The nymphs, they change color as they mature. So the youngest nymphs are black with white spots. And then the penultimate or the ultimate nymphs, the ones that are mature and going to turn into adults next, are red with black spots.
I also like describing the eggs to people because I think when they lay their eggs, it looks really interesting. They put this sort of epoxy all over the top of them, almost like a resin or a muddy material. And it makes it look like somebody is just been going around randomly spackling trees and objects in your yard. And then when that opens up and the eggs hatch, they look like empty coin purses when they get left behind.
So it looks like you let someone pretty inexperienced spackle your wall.
You hired a mason. Surfaces. Yeah. You hired a really bad mason who was like, I'm going to test it over here first. And
and on top of it and beside it everywhere. And around it and up high and down low and on the car.
So my first exposure to this insect was actually with Mike at ESA. He was explaining it to me a few years ago. And Mike, do you remember this? There was a poster from somebody at Penn State.
I do.
And they brought them dead, pinned in a box, and you could take one home with you.
Yeah, it was before I came to Penn State, so I wasn't involved in that, and I don't know who the student was, but that was one of the neatest things I've ever seen in an ESA poster.
Yeah.
Having not live specimens, having preserved specimens available to take home. And it's a great way to get the word out about it, because at that point, that was in like 2015 or 16. So spotted lanternfly was known in the state and we knew it was going to be an issue, but it was not known nationally, like even within entomology. So getting specimens out so people could look for it and know what it looked like and know what size it was a genius idea. And I snagged one, which is funny now that I'm here, I'm in the process of donating my personal collection to the Frost Museum here. So like, that specimen is ultimately going to come back and live in the museum.
Go back home. Yeah.
Yep.
Probably should mention like what actually it is, because it's not a cicada, right? It's like a plant hopper.
They're fulgorids. It's neat from a taxonomic perspective because we have fulgorid plant hoppers. It's one of those groups where we use the scientific name and the common name. The family is Fulgoridae and we call them fulgorid plant hoppers. There aren't very many in the United States. They're not super diverse here. And the ones that we do have aren't typically very big. In the tropics, they get fairly big. The peanut bugs. Do you know what the name for the other lantern flies are? People may have seen them. They have this big peanut-shaped protrusion on the front of the face. They're fairly big. They're inches long. They're maybe the most famous fulgorid.
Yeah, that's a cool bug.
But spotted lanternflies are in that same group. So it's kind of neat. From that perspective, like this new invasive, it's not a group that is well represented in the United States. What ones we have aren't nearly as big as spotted lanternflies. So that's kind of cool, even if the bug themselves are terrible.
And they're described as like 1 inch long and then half an inch wide.
They're fairly sizable. If you look at it, you're like, that's not a small bug. Like 1 inch sounds fairly small until you get it in hand. You're like, that's not that little.
Until it's a bug, then 1 inch.
It's a bug, then 1 inch is huge.
So we've kind of been hitting around at how devastating of a pest this can be. I think it's important to kind of highlight some of the industries that are at risk for this. And this is something that's kind of fresh in my mind. This is something that has been in the news here in Kentucky recently because there was a find this summer in southern Indiana. Spotted lanternfly kind of snuck in and became one of the sub pests of the summer in this area. We dealt mostly with the fall armyworm and things, but there has been some interest in this insect because it was found just across the river in Switzerland County, Indiana, which was a big jump for it. It had been in Ohio previously. There was a new Ohio find this summer as well, but there was also a find in Kansas, which I think we'll talk more about here in a few minutes. But the reason that we're kind of concerned with this is that it does threaten things like viticulture. It's a great pest. It gets on grapevines and feeds on them. As a hemipteran, it has a piercing, sucking mouth part, so it's sucking sap out of the plants. It's a pretty prodigious feeder. Is that fair to say, Mike?
Yes. The big reason that they're pests is because they feed so much on the plants. They are feeding on the sap of plants. They have piercing, sucking mouth parts that they insert into the plants and they suck the sap out. Plant sap is very poor in lipids. It's high in carbohydrates. It's sugary, right? You think of like maple syrup. We make maple syrup because sap is high in sugar. But because it's so low in lipids, they've got to eat a lot of it. And like other hemipterans that feed on plants, they shunt a lot of those carbohydrates out because they're useless. They're looking, you know, they get what they need, shunt the rest out, and then keep eating to get the lipids out. And so because of that, they are just sucking plants dry. They often won't kill plants the first year or two of feeding. But, you know, you can get masses of spotted lanternflies on trees and on grapevines and other woody plants that are so thick, they suck so much energy out of the plants that 2 years ago, so the most recent stat I can remember, we had a place that was heavily infested, a vineyard, 50 acres of grapes that didn't get one marketable grape out of that vineyard.
Wow.
They're just sucking so many nutrients out of those plants that the plants are alive, but they don't have enough extra energy to make the grapes that we are after.
So yeah, I think this is easy for most folks to conceptualize. You've probably dealt with aphids on a plant before. It's the same process, just at a much grander scale. I also think it sounds a lot like having a lot of ticks on your dog or your cow, right? If you've got a cow that's covered in ticks, they may live, they may survive that process, but they'll not gain the weight that you want because they're so stressed out. The same is true of these plants. They can't produce the things that we want. So it happens to grapes. I know it gets into hops. Yep. The people that I've talked to the most about it here in Kentucky have actually been the hardwood producers. They're worried about what will happen to them if it gets into the state, if they'll be able to ship their products, because there can be strict quarantines put in place for it. I spoke to the Kentucky Maple Syrup Producers Association, because if it's on your maple tree, you're probably not going to be able to harvest a lot of maple syrup out of a tree that's been sucked dry. And also the Christmas tree growers, because it does get on white pine. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah. In Pennsylvania, the crops we're worried about direct damage to are grapes in vineyards, because they like grapevines, and tree fruits. So they really like apples and other tree fruits. We've got a fairly decent sized peach industry here. We grow a lot of apples. The same thing happens in those. Your trees typically don't die, at least the first year, but you'll get reduced yield. There is some evidence that after a couple of years of very heavy infestations, trees may decline and die. They're being sucked so dry over so many years that they just can't withstand it. So those are direct impacts. And then, yeah, of course, there's other indirect impacts, say things with quarantine that, not being able to ship your hardwood product or your other products because it might be infested with lanternfly is an economic impact. But there's also sooty mold. So all of those carbohydrates that the spotted lanternflies are shunting out of their body in the form of honeydew, that's got to go somewhere. It lands on the ground beneath them or on the plants beneath them. And various molds and fungi and bacteria like to eat that. And it forms this substance called sooty mold. It varies by what species are making up the sooty mold, because it's not just one thing. It's a combination of various fungi and molds and bacteria, but they typically are very smelly and black. They'll stain whatever they're growing on. So if you have a deck under a tree that's infested with spotted lanternfly, that deck will be black. And even if you power wash it, you can't get the color off. If that sooty mold is growing on, say, your apples or your grapes, even if you do get some fruit produced, it might be unmarketable because it's covered in sooty mold.
And I imagine if there's that many insects feeding in a lot of places where it's an event or an experience to come pick your own fruit, that would be a little bit horrifying for people.
Yeah. You don't want to pick fruit that's covered in mold and have to wash it off. It's right. There goes that business.
Yeah. And that's why probably urban and suburban areas are not wanting any of those if that's going to be at your house, because we already get those calls about lace bugs or aphids.
I'm guessing, Mike, you've been to some of these spots where the infestations have been pretty thick and you've seen some of the honeydew.
I have not, actually.
Oh, really? Okay. So I'll talk about it, because I have gotten to go to one site that was pretty heavily infested, the Switzerland County one. And the smell that you mentioned really struck me in the face when we walked into the area where the lantern flies were feeding. It smelled like an old moldy sort of sack of sugar water. It was really gross out there. And the air literally hummed. This stuff also recruits other insects to come and feed on it. And you could just look around and there were bumblebees and yellow jackets and honeybees licking it up everywhere. There were a ton of flies that were visiting the spot just to try and drink some of this honeydew. It was a lot of bugs. So I could see that also being sort of a quality of life thing, where if you not only have these invasive species attacking your plants, but they're recruiting all of these other possible stinging insects to your property, that can be pretty annoying too.
That reminds me of something I forgot about, but in spotted lanternfly areas, honeybees going to spotted lanternfly honeydew is a big issue for apiaries.
Interesting.
It can affect the taste of the honey. Some people, I think, trying to market it, because it can be marketable. It just tastes different.
Okay.
I found it off-putting. I think right. I've tried some. I've seen it come across like the extension bulletins that I get for like upcoming webinars and learning opportunities and stuff. There have been webinars that we've put on for like dealing with honeybees and spotted lanternfly areas. Like, how do you get them to not go to honeydew if you want your honey to taste good?
that's a really interesting thing to bring up. It kind of takes me off on a tangent a little bit. So we'll get back to some of these other things here in a moment. But we've been talking about the plants that they feed on, and you mentioned this off-putting taste. I know that the primary host for spotted lanternfly is tree of heaven, which is another invasive species, which is chemically defended. It has its own sort of chemical defenses that the lanternflies are they able to absorb it, similar to like what we've talked about in the past with a monarch when they feed on milkweed? I guess what I'm building towards is the reason that these honeybees feeding on the honeydew coming from the spotted lanternfly, is there a trace of that chemical defense in it?
I don't think so. I don't think that's the reason.
It's because it's sticky butt juice that they turned into honey.
I know,
instead of nectar.
Yeah, how do you market that?
I can imagine a very specific marketing campaign with butts on it.
Yeah. It would be like double digested honey juice, right? I mean, like something, it came out of two bugs.
So there's a couple things in there that I think are really interesting. So you mentioned Alanthus or tree of heaven. In the early stages of the spotted lanternfly infestation, we thought they do preferentially feed on tree of heaven. They really like it. And we thought that that might be a really good control measure. We've got this invasive tree. If we could eliminate that, then maybe we can eliminate spotted lanternfly if that's the only thing they're feeding on, and like get a double whammy, like take one out and take the other out. Right. And there were some, you know, there were some early investigations into using fungal controls to kill Alanthus. You know, you'd go up, cut a notch in the tree, squirt it with this fungal pathogen, and it kills it. In tree of heaven, because they're invasive, they have allelopathic chemicals where they kill other plants in the area. So they grow in these big monocultures, and they also tend to root graft. So if you kill one tree with a fungus, you can kill a whole grove of them, which is great. But it turns out that spotted lanternflies are really prolificous. They love tree of heaven, but they also love a lot of other things. There was one paper that came out 2020.
103?
Worldwide, there's 172 host records from 103 different plant taxa across 33 families in 17 orders. And that's up. Before this paper came out, there was 65 hosts known. So they are fairly prolificous. They'll feed on a lot of different things. One thing we've been noticing in Pennsylvania is that they tend to host switch through the season, and we're not entirely sure why. The nymphs feed on things like rose and perennial crops, like flowers and things, probably because their mouth parts are small enough they can't pierce bark. So they're feeding on not quite woody plants, but like woody adjacent plants. Like think of a rose bush. It's not really woody, but it's still, you know, kind of like that. It's got thinner bark.
Yeah, it's the woody ornamental.
Yeah. So they'll feed on that kind of stuff. And then as they get bigger, the hosts switch onto grapes and tree of heavens. As they get bigger, and the adults will get onto things like black walnuts and butternuts. And then even later in the season, they'll switch onto birches and willows and sumacs and maples. They're prolificous. They feed on a lot of things. They still have preferences. And those preferences can change through the season as they get bigger.
One of the things that I was reading from Penn State talked about how towards the end of the development, they do like to switch back to tree of heaven, though. It seemed like that was sort of a terminal point for them, which is good in one way because we know where they're going, but also bad because it would be harder to control them with an insecticide once they're reaching that adult form. Even if we're putting systemics in those trees, it seems like it would be difficult to get them to absorb enough of it, to ingest enough of it to kill them.
So they do like tree of heaven. It is a preferred, maybe the most preferred host.
Right.
In the absence of tree of heaven, they'll feed on a bunch of other stuff. Right, and even in the presence of it, if you've got just a bunch of spotted lanternflies, they'll get on other stuff. And they can do their entire development on tree of heaven. The youngest nymphs can get on it and feed fine. It is used, especially in some of the earlier recommendations on control. Tree of heaven is, oh gosh, is it dioecious, where you've got male and female plants? So if you can figure out which are your male trees, you cut down 90% of the tree heaven in an area and just leave male trees so you don't get seeds. Like if you're killing one invasive, you might as well kill the other. And then you, exactly that, you treat them with systemics so that when the spotted lanternflies feed, they all die. And it works really well. You can kill a lot of spotted lanternflies that way. Now, does that make an impact like in the overall population?
One other thing kind of adjacent to what we were talking about before. So we were talking about some of those direct impacts on certain industries, and then you mentioned some indirect impacts, Mike. I was kind of curious if we could get your Pennsylvanian perspective, perhaps three P's in a row right there, on what's the quality of life impact of this? I mean, I've seen some videos and GIFs and images of these things in people's backyards. And I mean, it's a whole tree that it's just absolutely covered in bugs. There's swings attached to them. And so they're cut. These kids' swings and play sets are covered in honeydew. I mean, how annoying is this? And like the quarantine as well. I've seen like parking tag looking objects in people's photos on their mirrors. Do you get inspected when you go in and out of these kinds of spots? Like what is happening to Pennsylvanians that are dealing with this?
So there's a couple aspects of that. I'll back up a little bit just to get the economic impact. There have not been like really wide scale, really precise numbers put to spotted lanternfly damage. But the one estimate that I've seen, just kind of aggregating everything, like all of the direct impacts through crop loss, all of the indirect impacts through quarantine and having to deal with quarantine and job loss and pesticide application, Pennsylvania alone, we're looking at maybe $325 million a year impact, which is not a small number. It is expanding once it's already broken out of Pennsylvania. If it becomes widely established across the eastern U.S., like we're looking at multiple billions of dollars a year in impact. As far as quality of life goes, it's really annoying. I do get calls from homeowners like, how do I control this on my property? Like you said, we'll try to post some videos in the show notes. Like, listeners, check it out, because it really is unreal to see some of these. These trees are so covered. These insects are packed shoulder to shoulder that you go up and you brush your hand against it, and there are tens of hundreds of them just falling off under your hand.
Yeah, there's one video I think of in particular. This guy drags his forearm through them, and it's like cutting the chaff from the wheat. Like, there's just hundreds of cascading insects that fall down.
Yeah, it's bonkers. And yeah, it can be a big problem. You know, homeowners can lose trees to it if you've got feeding over a long time. Direct economic impact to homeowners is, you know, less than like growers. You're not losing fruit crops and whatnot, but the sooty mold, like you said, getting on just stuff, decks and swing sets, like if you have a heavily infested backyard, it can make your backyard unusable, which is part of the reason that people prefer often to own like single family homes instead of apartments and whatnot.
Right.
Like, it makes that space unlivable. Even when they're gone, if you get black sooty mold on, say, a wooden deck, you can power wash that as much as you can. And that stain just does not come up. There's one photo in particular that somebody, they've got the bottom deck power washed and it's still like, you can see the black marks, and then just this black, shiny, sooty mold on the next step. And it's so gross. You know, aside from that, imagine maybe an older person trying to walk outside on their deck. It's wet and slick, maybe a fall, an accident waiting to happen. They can get on cars. That's gross.
Yeah.
Even, you know, they're in downtown Philly now. We're getting reports of them from Long Island. Even in heavily urbanized areas, they'll feed on trees and people will just see them around. There's a couple of videos from Philadelphia from last year, or the year before. The spotted lanternfly adults, when it's time to lay eggs, they often will try to fly and lay them not where they're feeding. They'll try to migrate a little bit. They're not great flyers, so they often don't get very far. We've got videos of them. If they can catch an updraft, if they can get the right kind of wind currents in the fall, which is often possible because it's, you know, you've got fronts moving through in the fall and they can get sucked up. They can go for, you know, hundreds of meters, maybe even a mile or more. But I've seen these videos from Philadelphia where these adult lanternflies are trying to migrate to a little further to lay eggs. And you've just got hundreds to thousands of them banging against buildings and dying. And so you've got just heaps of dead spotted lanternfly, like along the pavement and along sidewalks. And then you've got to go clean that up.
Or another bug will come and do it for you.
Yeah, that's the impact, the non-target impact, especially of using systemic insecticides, is something I'm curious about. If you've got these trap trees where you're treating tree of heaven with pesticide and then the lanternflies die, like that pesticide doesn't break down as soon as they feed on it. What happens to all the things then that come on,
like ants and other decomposers that are feeding on these dead lanternflies, you've got heaps of insecticide laced dead bodies. Like, what happens to the things that eat those then?
Good question. I don't know, but we'd have to grind some lanternflies up and see how that decomposes in their decomposing bodies.
Spotted lanternfly, they go through incomplete metamorphosis. So egg, they'll start as in those egg masses, and those eggs actually under that smear, they're like little seeds laid vertically on the smooth surface, whether it's a trunk or wherever. They overwinter in those egg masses. And they're weird because we're used to seeing, you know, females lay their eggs close to a host plant for their offspring, because that just makes sense. But spotted lanternfly seems to not make that kind of sense. And it's like, we're just going to lay you here and you'll go find your food. Luckily for them, as Mike said, they can eat a whole bunch of the things, so it doesn't really matter. And I guess when they're young, they can eat that tender plant tissue, so it's not that woodiness. And we've got a lot of tender plant tissue. Each egg mass, there's like 30 to 50 eggs that will turn into nymphs. Particularly where they are now established, they begin to emerge in May. So that's the time to look out for them. Then four nymphal instars before they become adults. In those later instars, that's when they go to those woody plants. And then the adults are going to be prevalent late July in Pennsylvania. September, November is when they're mating and laying eggs. And there's one generation per year. So they overwinter in those egg masses.
I'm very thankful they only have our univoltine, our one generation per year.
I do follow Heather Leach, who was working at Penn State doing the spotted lanternfly program. And her Twitter, she's got some really great videos of them like hopping and popping like popcorn and crawling up her legs when she's out in the field, because they have that tendency to go to the tallest object. I don't know. It was always fun to watch those videos because, you know, we don't have them here.
Right. So if the three of us were standing there, they'd all be crawling up me, is what you're saying.
I think they would all start to crawl up all of us, but then they'd
be like, oh, yeah. That's the tall arthropod.
Yes. Yeah.
The other things that I think are interesting to talk about with this pest, I mean, the current range is, I guess I'd say limited. Like the quarantine that was put into place for this, would you guys describe it as successful, at least initially?
It seemed like it was pretty successful initially, at least for the first couple of years. Honestly, I'm surprised it lasted as long as it did. So as it expands, we are slowly expanding the quarantine. But the initial quarantine area of 14 counties in southeastern Pennsylvania and then a couple counties in like adjacent New Jersey and whatnot, it stayed contained in there for quite a long time. The fear always was like it overwinters as these egg masses that look like mud splatters. You know, if you're not familiar with what you're looking at or difficult to see often, you know, imagine a brown splatter on a brown rock. They can really blend in, or on dark tree bark. They lay their eggs on any hard surface. So often it's tree bark, but it could be like the underside of your camper. We worried that eggs would get laid on a vehicle or a camper or a boat or something, and then somebody would take that out of state, and then boom, there goes the quarantine.
Didn't you once tell me that they were very intrigued if trains could carry them?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. So quarantine worked for a really long time, and then we'd get pop-ups here and there and maybe eradicate them, and it was great. Last year, all of a sudden, we had all these populations pop up. If you can imagine, Pennsylvania is this horizontally long state. They're in the southeast. And then all of a sudden, all these counties from the southeast, just straight across Pennsylvania to Pittsburgh, lit up with spotted lanternflies, and now they're all under quarantine. What we think happened is there is a major rail line right through that area. And there's major rail lines right through the area that the quarantine zone is. And trains didn't have to be inspected. They would come and stop maybe for a couple days in the area, and then they just keep going. I don't think they had to be inspected. You know, if they slowed down and didn't stop, but maybe they were going just a mile or two an hour, you wouldn't have to inspect them then, but that's slow enough that lanternflies could land on them. And yeah, we think that this big outbreak across the middle of the state towards Pittsburgh is probably because they were hitching rides on trains, like inseminated females. Then they would jump off and then lay their eggs along the rail lines, which is also a place like that kind of disturbed stony gravelly area is a place that Tree of Heaven really like to grow. They are really common along rail lines and railroad cuts and roadways. And so you've got like the host tree that they prefer growing along this rail corridor that they're hitching a ride on. And so we think that that's probably how they outbroke that long way across Pennsylvania.
That's interesting. We'll definitely include the most up-to-date map that we have. I get that usually from the New York State IPM program. Mm-hmm. They have a really good map that they keep updated. And you're right. Yeah, there is this straight line that just goes across Pennsylvania to the border, showing that they are just kind of zooming along right to Ohio. Yep. The other things that I think we would want to highlight here is that half of Pennsylvania does seem to be about infested. Is that fair to say, Mike?
Yeah. They've expanded north and east from that initial 14 counties. And then this straight shot across the state that kind of bisects north and south. All told, it's about half.
Okay. It looks like New Jersey is almost entirely infested, except for maybe one holdout county. Delaware is similar. It's starting to get up into New York and Connecticut. And there's an infestation present in Massachusetts, it looks like. The two that I've been most interested in, though, were the ones that were in Ohio. So we have one in a county right across the border from Pennsylvania. It's Jefferson County, Ohio. I've never been there, but it looks like it's got an infestation present. And then a new one that was in
Cayuga.
Cayuga. There we go. county that's up by Cleveland.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When you're in a quarantine, what are the rules? How does that work? How does that stop things and who enforces that?
So this is a really contentious issue in Pennsylvania. So it's a state level quarantine and we're quarantining county by county. What that means for us, at least what we're doing in our state, is the quarantine really only applies to commercial businesses. So if you're a business in the quarantine county, especially one that ships things like trucking companies or exporters, one of the earliest places they were found was in like a rock exporter. They get like slabs of rock from various places and then ship them. And you can imagine like brown mud splatter on rocks is difficult to find. They have to have somebody in the company. I don't recall all the exact details because I'm not involved with this, but that person has to like take a specific training on how to inspect for spotted lanternflies and what they look like. And then that person has to train other people at the company to know. So it's kind of like a train the trainer. And we're relying on people to know to do it and accurately report that they're doing it. And if you do that, you can get like little tags that go in your vehicles to show like, we know what we're doing. We've passed the training and we're inspecting our vehicles. And we expect that people are not lying about actually inspecting their product and inspecting their vehicles. For private citizens is the vast majority of movement in and out of quarantine zone. We've got like trainings that they can take and information out there, but there's no enforcement mechanism. No, like we're not requiring them to do anything. Like I said, it's contentious. It seemed a little, to me, it's like, well, you're not quarantining the biggest set of the population that has the potential to move this stuff. At the university level, anybody that travels in and out of the quarantine zone is required to take training and then inspect their vehicles before and after. Mm-hmm. And we've got, if you get like a fleet vehicle, they'll inspect it for you when you come back. But we have Penn State football games, especially pre-COVID, and you've got tens of thousands of people driving up, many of them from the quarantine zone. None of them are required to inspect their vehicles because they're private citizens. So we've been expecting them to establish an outbreak around Center County, centered on Penn State because of football games for a long time. We have had a couple adults found during football games, like that have hitched rides up on vehicles. Thankfully, they have not established here, but we keep expecting this influx of people every week or every other week because of this social event that we're not enforcing quarantine on. You know, in the quarantine zone, there have been things like big NASCAR events that, again, they're happening right during peak adult emergence when you expect the adults to be around and laying eggs, and there's no quarantine forced around that. It feels like the whole system, and I'm saying this from a personal view and not as an employee of Penn State, just to cover my butt a bit. It feels like the whole thing is really porous. There are fines, but trying to get the police to enforce those fines when they've got all kinds of other stuff to do is also very difficult. So it has very little teeth. So these are my personal views on the quarantine in Pennsylvania. It's not that it was bad. I just don't think it was enough. So it certainly helped, but we could have done more.
I was just interested to hear what you had to say. Yeah, because I guess I, you know, my experience with quarantines is more centered around Emerald Ash Borer. And I know there are some people that kind of dog that specific one and say, oh, well, you know, it's everywhere now. It didn't really work. But I guess I feel like it did help. This state, Kentucky in particular, I mean, we're not even fully infested yet. It's an insect that's been here since 2009, and it's not even present in every county. And I think that if we can think of these things as helping to slow it down so that we can educate and prepare people, that's a really good thing. I mean, no, it didn't stop it at the border and completely eliminate it. It's not the same level of success that we've had with Asian longhorn beetle in other spots. But I think the spotted lanternfly, the SLF quarantine, should be a model. I mean, the fact that we're just now talking about even Ohio and Indiana and more Western states, I think is to be lauded. I mean, when was the first find?
2014.
So 7 years ago.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, and like you said, Pennsylvania is not even fully infested yet. So some of that is biology of the insect, of course, but I think regulators in Pennsylvania should be applauded for all that they've done, for sure. And I think it was what you were saying is they're doing the best they can. It's hard to police everybody because nobody's going to make a spotted lanternfly task force with the Pennsylvania State Police, you know?
It's really frustrating because there's no money for enforcement or regulation up front. Like it's the whole problem we always have with invasives. But now we're expecting it's going to do $325 million in damage a year annually just in one state. Like if we would have put $100 million up front to eradicate this thing and do enforcement and keep it contained, maybe we could have eradicated it in the first year or two. But you know, if that had happened, then people were like, well, that's a waste. Why did we spend all this money? Well, now here we are. We're going to have billions of dollars in damage every year because we didn't spend some money up front. But nobody wanted to because if it works, then it's an invisible investment.
I actually really like that publication that you were talking about that's from Pennsylvania about the effects of it on industries, because there was one part that even talked about like 5,000 jobs could be lost. And I think being able to hold stuff like that up and say, oh, you know, this is where we're at. Like, this is what could happen. If you couch it in ways like that, say 5,000 people could lose their job in this one state because of this one bug. That's something I think in the future we should hold up with the next invasive and be like, we've seen this before. It'll happen again. Please help us to get rid of it before it becomes a pervasive problem.
I wanted to say something about, I guess, Emerald Ash Borer, because I think it can relate directly to spotted lanternfly. The idea that the quarantine and slowing the spread and that working, like it did, like we just had the last couple counties in Pennsylvania confirmed in the last year or two, and it got here in 2009.
Yeah.
In that time, we've had a couple biocontrol agents for Emerald Ash Borer come online. We have production facilities making millions of these wasps every year for release. You know, they're established across 24 states now, and in areas of Michigan where the biocontrol agents have been established for 5 or 10 years, we've seen drastic reductions in Emerald Ash Borer, and ash trees that are within the size range that they can infest are surviving. You know, we've lost all the biggest ash trees,
right?
But as a species, as a genus, they're not going to go extinct probably, and give it a generation and we'll have big ash trees again.
Right.
Because we slowed the spread and because we could get these wasps. We've got two biocontrol agents for spotted lanternfly in quarantine right now. They're nice. Both wasps. One attacks nymphs. It's a dryinid, which are called the pincher wasps. Their front forelegs are chelate or raptorial. They can grab their prey item and hold it as they lay eggs in it. And they're super cool.
That is super cool.
They're my favorite wasp group, or one of them. Another is an egg parasite that attacks the eggs. You know, they're in quarantine right now. We want to make sure that they're not going to attack native species, and that takes time. But the more we can slow the spread of this thing down and keep it more contained, the better chance we're going to have of getting good control with these biocontrol agents once they are approved for release and once we can ramp up production of them and get them spread across the state. If, you know, if we only have to treat Pennsylvania and a handful of surrounding states instead of the entire eastern United States, like that's a big difference.
It's true.
Rant over.
Well, I appreciate the rant. I think it's good stuff to hear. I just wanted to sort of talk about the quarantine a little bit, just, and I appreciate Jody following up on it because it does seem to have helped. I know that now I'm worried about it being in Indiana, which was sort of my personal experience with the lanternfly this summer, where I got a phone call from the Indiana DNR, or our department got a phone call from the Indiana DNR, Department of Natural Resources, and they invited the Office of the State Entomologist and me and Dr. Rick Besson up to Indiana to come and take a look. It was an interesting find. I don't want to share a whole lot of the information just because I don't know what the privacy laws or anything are, but basically a gentleman found a nymph on a tree of heaven that was on his property, and he turned it into the DNR. He was drinking coffee next to the tree and noticed it, he said, and he reported it, and they came out and they found that there was a full-fledged infestation there, multiple life stages all overlapping with each other. And like I said, we got to go there and take some video, and I got to hear all the bugs coming in to drink the honeydew. It was pretty astonishing. It's only about a couple, it's only a couple of miles from the river. So we've set up a lot of traps nearby, trying to make sure that it doesn't get into the state, but it is something that we're afraid that there's a bridge that goes from this county right across the Ohio River into Kentucky. People work and live on both sides of the river. So we're worried that it could be introduced that way. But the other things we think about are the rail lines, obviously, as we were talking about before. So it's just been an interesting summer. And I think the even more interesting story that came out about spotted lanternfly this year was in Kansas, which is out in Jody's neck of the woods. So can you explain to the folks what happened there, Jody?
I can, but I just wanted to ask about setting up traps. Can you explain those traps?
It's an interesting looking trap. So yeah, for a lot of these invasive species, we think about like big glue traps. I know Mike has had a long history of setting up purple board traps in trees to try and catch emerald ash borer and things. The best way I can describe them, they're see-through bagpipes. There's like a series of pipes that lead into sort of a central reservoir where the insect would be contained, and they're strung up in the tree. And I guess that they get lost in the tubing and go inside. Mike, are these traps in Pennsylvania, or do you have monitoring at all there? Or
are you talking about the circle traps?
I guess, yeah.
This is a neat thing that's come along in the last, I guess, year or two. They were developed for traps that were used initially for, I think, pecan weevils. So for a long time, we were using sticky bands, which aren't great. You can imagine you wrap a band around a tree and cover it in sticky glue. And what happens is nymphs and adults like to climb up. And so you've got all these spotted lanternfly low on the tree. They climb up and they get caught in the sticky trap and they die. Except the sticky traps can also catch things like birds, which is bad.
That's bad.
And they'll catch a lot of non-target insects. It was the best we had for a couple of years, but everybody's like, we need to do something different. The non-target effects are not great. We can't do this over a large scale. Like, we were using it for monitoring because that's all we had. There's these circle traps that were developed for pecan weevils, and somebody realized like we could just modify them a little bit and use them for spotted lanternfly. And what it is, you've got this ring kind of that goes around the tree. As the insect climb up, they intercept this ring, and then they're directed in and up into this clear plastic bag. And so you, now you've got a bag of almost entirely spotted lanternflies. Like, you'll get a couple non-target insects, like some ants and stuff that are crawling around, but not like the sticky bands, and you exclude all the vertebrates like the birds. We've actually got plans up on the Penn State website. You can buy commercial products, but you can also make your own with like a Ziploc bag. And we've got plans up on how to make your own for monitoring and for control. If you can, if you're throwing away Ziploc bags and bags full of spotted lanternflies, you're not going to control them on a population level, but you could control them in your own backyard and kill a lot of them and maybe reduce the population the following year.
Yeah, I was very surprised at how easy it was for the Office of the State Entomologist to put up. I didn't mean to be derogatory when I said see-through bagpipe.
No, it's fine.
That's what it looked like to me was, yeah, there was this big bag and there were, I guess they're not tubes, but there was like, there were avenues for them to get up towards the circle part, like either a ruler or something.
Yeah, like, and you direct them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's good to know. Like, I'm just so curious. I guess it's not a matter of if they're going to be here. It's kind of just when. And as we talked with Caitlin last week, it's all about monitoring and scouting and see what's out there and detecting early. But we can go to the Kansas story. The spotted lanternfly, they don't travel far on their own. That's what we were talking about and how they've, you know, used us humans, vehicles, RVs, rail cars to get where they're going. And this summer, actually, just last month in September, there was a detection in Kansas, which is very close to us in Nebraska. So this is, we're on alert. The interesting thing was it was found in a 4-H'er's entomology project at the fair. So the student or the 4-H'er correctly identified it as a plant hopper, but didn't know it was invasive. And this started this federal investigation because one of the judges was familiar with the insect and the requirements of reporting it. So they reported it to the USDA and the program leader. It's funny because the fair board says, we had one entomology issue. So that's what the statement was. But like the nearest infestation to this county or where it was found is 850 miles away in Ohio. So we're on alert because it's the closest one to us.
That's cool that it was found in a 4-H'er's project. It would have been neat if the 4-H'er knew what they had found. I'm glad that somebody like there looking at it knew what it was, knew how to report it. Like that chain could have fallen apart at any stage. And I'm glad it didn't.
Right. And it's only like the single one they've found. They're not sure how it's, I think they're still under investigation. There's no other sightings. They say it may have come from a camper. I wanted to let you know that the 4-H'er got a blue ribbon.
Congratulations to them. This is also a good highlight for why it's important to have your collection information on the label, right, Mike?
Yes. Where'd you get this? Oh, I don't remember.
Well, it's really important that you sit down and think about it.
But there was it you that was telling me about the Japanese beetle in North Dakota? That was like a bad label.
Yeah, you don't remember the story Dr. Aceto told us when we were...
Vaguely, but I think you remember it better.
He told us when he was a professor at North Dakota State that he had a collection requirement as part of his class, and somebody had taken... In his class, they had brought their collection in, and one of the samples in there was a Japanese beetle pinned, and he had made a label that said he'd caught it in, like, Fargo, North Dakota or something, you know, just like... wherever he said he caught the rest of them. It sounded like they hauled him in, put him in the interrogation room. You got to tell us where you found this. We got to go there and see if this is widespread in this area. And it turned out
they weren't found. Japanese beetles weren't known from North Dakota.
Yeah, that was not part of their range at the time. And it turned out that he had either gotten it from a friend or had gone east on vacation and picked it up. And he just made all of his labels the same. He didn't have collection data really. And he just like pinned it, slapped a label under it and turned it in. But they were ready to release the hounds, I think, to go out and find it. Cause yeah, that would have been a big jump for it, I think, in the time frame that he was describing. So if you are making an insect collection, it is important to write down what county and what state you collected the bug in.
Well, even wasn't there something on, was it Reddit? I'm not on Reddit, but wasn't there something someone posted a spotted lantern fly? Like, was it earlier this year, last year, sometime? And it was like through a friend, because, you know, everyone sends pictures of bugs from a friend. My friend wants to know what this is. And they put it somewhere and everybody flipped out and they didn't come back online for a while. And
No, that sounds about right.
Okay. Everyone flipped out because all the entomologists are like, where are you from? Where did you get this? We need to stop it, kill it, blah, blah, blah. And the person's offline, like, just posted a picture. What is this?
I'll catch up with this later.
Yeah. And it turned out it was a friend in like New Jersey or New York, somewhere where the spotted lantern fly is closer, not where the person who posted was.
I actually think that's a good segue though, to maybe start part of our closing argument here is to talk about, I mean, people do travel a lot. People go into areas where they could encounter this pest potentially if we've got RVs and campers and lots of exchanges of fauna from places. So if you are on the road, we've described what it looks like. If you see something weird, we hope that you'll report it. But where would you guys send people to try and report those kinds of findings?
It depends on where you're at. Pennsylvania residents can report potential spotted lanternflies to PA Department of Agriculture at, they have a great bad bug email. We also have a reporting form through Penn State that they can report it through. I don't know what New Jersey and other states that have confirmed sightings and confirmed populations. I imagine their Department of Agriculture also have ways to report it. If you're outside of the quarantine zones, like say you're in Kansas, reach out to the USDA. Just Google like spotted lanternfly USDA, you'll find ways to report it because they're going to want to know, especially if you are, like I said, outside the quarantine zone. Please tell somebody if you think you found it.
I'm sure people in call your local extension office. We want to make sure we get it ID'd, get a picture, save it. Don't
right.
throw it away.
Yes.
Get a video or something, exact location of where you are. And I mean, I would definitely work with our Nebraska Department of Ag, and we would want to confirm that before it goes anywhere.
Yep. I mean,
online or to the media, right?
What you just said is very key, because I've dealt with this now, I think twice, where people have said, oh, I found it. I found the spotted lanternfly in Kentucky. I just need you to confirm it. And I say, okay, send me the bug or send me your picture. Oh, I don't have any of that. Well, then I can't confirm anything. Right. There was one that we were very keen on finding more out about, because it was by Mammoth Cave National Park, an area conceivably where campers and people and stuff are all coming in and out all the time. It would be a potential first find in the state, I think. And somebody called and said they had found it there. He had a picture. They had confirmed it through iNaturalist. And I said, well, I need that picture. I need to see this. And long story short, it turned out that his son, who had told him about this, had taken a picture from the Penn State entomology website and run that through iNaturalist and told his dad what he had found. And that was what he had found he had taken a picture of. So we need evidence. If you're making an extraordinary claim, I think this is one of, I stole this from Mike in the past. If you're making an extraordinary claim, we need extraordinary evidence. Like, you need to have something to back up what you're saying. So if you find it, keep it, take a picture, take a video, and then report that to your extension service, your state DNR, or Department of Natural Resources, whatever it's called there, your Department of Ag in the state. You need to get a government official of some sort involved to help confirm it and start the regulatory process in your area.
Just to echo that, they're really distinctive insects. There is nothing, if you see a picture of a spotted lanternfly, you're probably not going to confuse it with much, but every insect that has spots is not a spotted lanternfly. I have gotten multiple people that have submitted giant leopard moths.
Yes.
As spotted lanternflies, because it's an insect that's large and has spots. Well, no, this is a white moth with black spots on it. This is not a khaki pink not moth with black spots on it. Like, so
I've thank gotten, you for turning it in and being aware. Yeah.
I would rather look at 10,000 things that aren't spotted lanternfly and make sure we catch the ones that are outside of the quarantine zone. Like, that's fine. I'm glad people are sending them in.
Want to hear my Nebraska story?
Yes.
Okay. So it was a couple months ago. So it was in the beginning of August. And I get an email that was forwarded through the general email here, gets forwarded to me. And the subject line just said, I just spotted a spotted lantern fly in my backyard, fourth instar. So it was forwarded to me and the state entomologist with NDA. And they were convinced, because everyone's usually convinced of what they see, right? So you don't want to say like, no, that's, you're wrong. So you have to talk to them. And when I said, well, when they're nymphs, they're not going to really be flying around things and adults have wings. And then she changed and she said, no, it's an adult. I was wrong. I looked it up online. It was an adult. We were all sure that it was likely a moth that she had seen. She lived close to where I lived. So I stopped by on my way home and she took me out to the backyard. She showed me like this big raised bed of impatience flowers. And she was like, it was right here. And it was like hovering and it was feeding. And I was like, okay, that does not sound like spotted lanternfly. They were like, nope, nope, nope. So I said, you know, I saw a moth this morning. It was really cool. It was a white line sphinx moth and it was feeding and it was hovering and got some pink, you know, on the wings. And she's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, I'm going to get home. I'm going to send you a video. So I went home, sent her an email. And she's like, you hit the nail on the head. I'm so sorry to put you through all that trouble. Thank you for being part of Extension. And then it was me like, thank you for knowing and looking for invasive species. Like, we need people like you to keep their eyes open. So it was a relief, but also we kind of knew that it wasn't. So just knowing about the insect and its behavior and biology, like, it just cannot feed like that. That's not how it works. And it's going to hop. It's not going to hover. And it doesn't have this kind of mouth part. It's not feeding on the nectar of flowers. But it worked out well that time. You guys have any interesting stories?
Mine is mainly going to Switzerland County and getting to see sort of the newest infestation at that time. And getting to hear from the Indiana folks about what they were going through, trying to confirm it. It was a really interesting thing because even people from Ohio had shown up that were part of their spotted lanternfly SWAT team, I guess. I don't know how else to describe it. And also the people that they use for Asian longhorn beetle, they had come over and they were sort of giving advice on what to do next. So it was just interesting to see all of this cooperation between states, the tri-state area, quote unquote, that we call it up there, and to have it be kind of humbling to know this will be in my backyard sooner rather than later. And I have to start preparing some extension materials for it.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys in Kentucky thinking like, okay, what kind of task force are we going to get together when this thing gets here? Because it's going to get here.
I haven't heard anything is the way I would say it. You know, Rick Besson and I, we're planning what we're going to do as the extension folks. And the Office of the State Entomologist, they know what they're going to do. They are our regulatory folks that would be sort of designated for that. And I think that they do have a plan in place. This has been their priority pest. It had been EAB, emerald ash borer, for a long time, which was then supplanted by Asian longhorn beetle because we have that population in southern Ohio just across the river. And then that has now been supplanted, I think, by spotted lantern, which happened before even the find in Indiana. We're worried about what it means for Kentucky ag. We have a big hardwood industry that ships lumber everywhere, and there's a lot of concern with it. So I think they have a distinct plan in place. I think that we'll play a part, but I don't know if I will know my part until the play has begun.
It's interesting how different states tackle that, because when it got here, everything was kind of routed through Penn State.
Right.
We had a spotted lanternfly coordinator. We were the epicenter of all the research. Like, we certainly coordinated with Department of Ag, and they were the ones dealing with the quarantine and the legal issues. But like, a lot of the response was by Penn State, which I thought was a little weird, because, you know, we are the big research institution with entomology, but also we're not the Department of Agriculture.
I think we'll be in the same boat, because we are sort of unique if you compare our situation to other states in Kentucky. The Office of the State Entomologist is housed in our department, and our department chair is automatically the state entomologist. So they are, I don't want to say more powerful than other offices of the state entomologist, but they seem to be more, they're more plugged into our land grant university. So I think that we'll be very plugged into the process, just like you were describing. It'll be a lot of UK driven things. Sorry to be all the bearers of bad news all the time, right?
Does Nebraska, do you know if they have any plans for spotted lanternfly?
Well, after this 4-H project in Kansas, it's raised the hair on the back of our necks, and we're just ready to start getting some educational material together geared for Nebraskans. So I've been communicating with the Nebraska Invasive Species Program leader there, working on some posters or cards or something like that. I'm going to talk to Julie Van Meter from Nebraska Department of Ag. We just want to be ready. And I think our problem is mostly just getting the word out. So just having accurate information. So we're not really sure when they're going to pop up and how far they can be from Ohio, Kansas, Pennsylvania. Yeah, we'll work on it. But I know that we are very worried and trying to get ahead of it, but we'll see.
And we all need your help, those of you that are listening, to be able to stay ahead of some of these problems. So if you do see something weird, we do encourage you, like we have said, to take a photograph, take a video, collect the specimen, make sure that you submit it to some sort of government agency. We appreciate everybody listening today to learn a little bit more about this invasive species. Like I said before, we have an exciting Halloween spectacular coming up. Please send us questions you might have for Dr. Erica McAllister, or if you're just interested in flies. I think it will be a very cool show. I know that we're all very excited about it, right, guys?
Yeah.
We should say what the book is, in case anybody wants to go out and get the book and read it.
It's The Secret Life of Flies. It is available on Amazon. I think, is it the number one insect book on Amazon right now? It was in the top 10 or 20, I think.
It's very popular.
It's very popular. Very well written. We're going to be focusing specifically on the parasitoid fly chapter, though. It's spread out in some of the different ways that they feed or develop. So that's what we're going to be doing next. We hope that you'll tune in. In the meantime, if you want to find the show, you can find us on any of your favorite podcatcher apps. We're on Stitcher. We're on Apple Podcasts. We are on Spotify now. But to find us there, you have to type in you have to type in, don't laugh at me. You have to type in, you're killing me, Smalls. You have to type in arthro-pod. If you forget the dash, you will not find us. You will find all these other playlists that are centered around arthropods and maybe are lobster themed or something. With the dash, you will find our podcast. So if you want to help the show, spread the word, give us a rating or review on those different podcatcher apps that you use. We were deeply appreciative of those that have done so. And you can find us on Twitter. We're arthro_podshow. I am also on Twitter. I am at BugmanJohn.
I am at JodyBugsMe, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla36.
We hope that you will tune in here in a couple of weeks for our Halloween spectacular. But until then, hope you go out and enjoy the last embers of summer and the beginning of autumn. Maybe find some more bugs. And we'll catch you here next time.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
Join Jody Green as she crawls through crypts to describe insects.
You know what? That would be fun. If I knew that I was crawling around in the cemetery with you guys looking for bugs, that would be fun.